computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for T1 at 20K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are a go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Leno Sanic. Today we're going to be speaking to author Johnny Cairns. Hello, Johnny.
How you doing, Len?
Thank you very much for taking time to speak to me today. And you're from the UK, Edinburgh.
I said earlier other times they're from the UK, and then I had to think, whereabouts in the UK? It's a big place, so.
Well, we're up the north, so. Scott, the UK, obviously made up Scotland, England, and Wales and Ireland. So, but there's a big, and it has been for a number of years now, Scotland seeking its own independence. So that could be happening in the future, which I would be fully behind. But we just got to wait and see what happens.
Okay, well, you have a new article up at Kennedy's and King. Part 1 and Part 2 is up there, and it's entitled Our Lady of the Warren Commission, and that is making reference to Ruth Payne. And I wanted to help promote this article and your good work, so I thought I'd get you on to help discuss it, promote it, and maybe you could tell me what was the catalyst that got you to write about Ruth, to write about the assassination, and what got you interested to do your investigation, and then we're going to discuss the lecture that you heard her speak at, and your observations and critique of that. So take it away.
Yeah, it was last November 20th. So I was going to Dallas last year for the 60th anniversary, and before I'd went over, I got a message from Gabrielle Zediker, who helps out run Lancer now, and pals with the Zedekers, and her husband Kenneth was going to this talk in Irvine on November 20th, and it was to see Ruth Payne, and I was asked, would you be interested in going? I was like, well, yeah. Obviously, because of how she's linked to this case and the fact that she is one of the last living witnesses, if you want to call her that, to the events surrounding this whole the whole assassination, I thought, yeah, I'll definitely want to go and see her. So booked my ticket, and then I told everyone in the Dealey Plaza UK chat that I was going to see this Ruth Payne talk, and would anyone be interested in coming along? Well, everybody did. Everybody said, yeah, let's do it. So when I was over there, I think the first day, actually, I arrived in Dallas. It was November 16th. And when I was there, went out for a big meal at night and at Campese's, which I think the first visitor to Jack Ruby was Joe Campese, if I can remember correctly. Robert Groden was there, Chocolcelli was there. There was all sorts of different people there, and it was good to kind of speak to everyone. And then the next day, on the 17th, I was going to Lancer, but then I ended up going to the Ruth Payne home as well, because in 2018, I actually hadn't got a chance to step inside the house, and I wanted to do it this time. So when I was there, I got the tour of the house, and you know, I was in the garage and the kitchen and seen it all. And that was good knowledge to have, the layout of the house, because I was going to see this talk on the 20th in Irvine. And the guy who showed me around the Ruth Payne house, he was a tour guide from the city of Irvine. And the guy was fantastic. He was great. He was a really nice guy. Can't remember his name. I want to say Ken. But anyway, it was basically like a private tour. There was no one else but me and two other guys from Dealey Plaza, UK. And inside the garage was a man liquor, etc. So anyway, the 20th rolls round, and we had started to make our way to the roof paint talk. But it's funny because when we were going down to meet our taxi, we all got stuck in a lift. And we had to get the fire department to break us out of the lift to go to the roof paint talk. And afterwards, I actually said I wish they just left us in the lift because it would be much more educational, you know, to stay in the lift rather than go out to this talk. So ends up there, we gets in, couple of minutes to spare, and Ruth Payne and Thomas Mallon are on the stage and they're getting introduced. And, you know, it's the same old, this is Ruth Payne, you know, Oswald stayed at her house the night before the assassination, etc. So after the introductions, and almost within, I would say, 5 minutes, Ruth Payne basically announced Lee Harvey Oswald's guilt to the audience. Now, the audience, it was a kind of eclectic mix of individuals. You had, obviously, the Dealey Plaza UK crowd, and then you had Robert Grodin was there with his wife Janet. They were in the front row. But you can actually see them on the video because the whole talk's on YouTube. Jeff Meek was there, who's another researcher, another good researcher. And there was, obviously, people that advocate for the Warren Commission that was there as well. So it was a very eclectic crowd. But yeah, Mrs. Payne declared Oswald guilty almost straight off the bat, which I was expecting that. Of course I was. But when she declared it so readily and it was accepted by certain elements of the crowd, I got kind of uneasy about it. And quite, don't want to say angry, but quite annoyed that this was just going to be a Oswald's guilty, you know, trust me, I'm a doctor type situation. There was not going to be any evidence offered. But the one thing, I suppose, that did strike me as quite a surprise was the fact that Mrs. Payne never really spoke about the Kennedy case per se. She spent most of her time trying to push the idea that Oswald was guilty of trying to attempt to assassinate General Walker. And Scott Reed, who is in Dealey Plaza, UK, who was there that night, the whole General Walker assassination attempted killings, his whole bag. He's really good at, Scott's really interested in the case. He's wrote an article for Kennedys and King about it, which everyone should check out. But yeah, she was really trying to push this narrative that Oswald was guilty at trying to kill General Walker. And I was waiting on, you know, any kind of semblance of evidence to be offered. But all that was offered was the backyard photographs and the testimony of Marina Oswald, which is a really shaky ground because, obviously, as you know, Marina's credibility in this case is non-existent, and it was non-existent even during the life of the Warren Commission. And to really rely on her testimony is really to be ill-advised in this case. Many people have spoken about her credibility, people like Fred Scobie, for example, Norman Redlich, and they've all been scathing of her. I think Nick Redlich actually turned around and outright called her a liar. So yeah, so they were offering the backyard photographs, you know, they were saying that Oswald had taken these, Marina had taken these photographs March 31, and this was the gun he was going to use to try and kill Walker with. Well, the first thing that sprung to my mind was, well, that would be wrong because the bullet actually recovered from the Walker case was a 30.06, and that bullet has somehow transformed from a lead-coloured projectile to a copper-coated 6.5 Mannlicher Kirkcannon ammunition. So, and for months, the Dallas police were, before the assassination, had it down that the bullet fired at Walker was from a 30-06 rifle. So I was expecting, no, sorry, I wasn't expecting them to tell the audience that. But when they never, I was kind of, it kind of reinforced what I kind of thought this was going to be, like a dog and pony show. And the whole, it was just basically, the whole talk was centred on, it was a rehashing of the Warren Commission. It was Oswald was guilty, and they never offered anything to really substantiate the claim at all. So that's why in the article, I went through the evidence in the Walker case, and I tried to give Oswald a defence in the Walker case. And, yeah, and then it went from there, and it went to kind of other aspects about how Oswald basically was a malcontent, how he used to beat his wife. And there was also a section where Mrs. Payne produces a folder as a tribute to Priscilla McMillan Johnson. And I found that to be pretty funny. Do you know who Priscilla is?
Yes, we know who she is. I would say a CIA asset. And she wrote a book about Marina Oswald.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah,
you know,
there was a funny section. So during this tribute to Priscilla, because Priscilla, Mrs. Payne, and Michael Payne and Thomas Malham were all friends, there was a photograph that came on. There was an overhead projector, and there was various photographs being shown, as I've said, the backyard photographs. And then there was this picture, and it was of Michael Payne, Priscilla, and Ruth Payne at this barbecue. And the picture was taken by Thomas Malham. We're all in a Dealey Plaza UK WhatsApp chat. And as soon as this kind of photograph was flashed on the screen, Neil Safety, who is the secretary of Dealey Plaza UK, had messaged the chat saying, Michael, Priscilla and Ruth at a CIA barbecue. Well, everyone in the Dealey Plaza, because we were sitting all kind of next to each other, we're all kind of sniggering and laughing, and people were kind of looking around going, you know, what are these guys laughing at? But yeah, that was quite funny, and it turned out actually to kind of be the highlight of the evening, because it never got any, because it just stayed on that kind of same plateau. It plateaued to Oswald and his mindset and all this kind of stuff. But another thing that Ruth Payne and Thomas Malham were really trying to hammer home was that Oswald was seeking fame through the assassination. They said that basically Oswald was a malcontent, that his life wasn't going well, and that's why he killed President Kennedy. Well, again, anyone that knows this case knows that that's just not what the record supports. The record supports my position and a lot of people's positions that Oswald was innocent. And when he was being accused of the murder of Patrolman Tippett and President Kennedy, he actually vehemently denied it. And I couldn't believe that they were trying to sell this to the audience, you know. Oswald was seeking fame, and it couldn't be any further from the truth. I mean, Oswald says himself, you know, I don't know what dispatches you people have been given, but I emphatically deny these charges.
Yeah. Well, you called it earlier. You called it a dog and pony show. And for people who don't know what that is, it's just like a circus act.
Yeah. I mean, Len, it was really bad. During the talk, we kind of were discussing whether we should stand up and walk out on protest. Because this
I
is
love
the thing.
It. Yeah.
This is the thing. Like, everyone should have the presumption of innocence. Now, Oswald's been dead 60 years, okay? But when you're coming out in public, and especially as somebody who's so tied to these events like Ruth Payne, is coming out in public and declaring Oswald as guilty, then on what ground? She must be on firm ground to do that. She must offer evidence to the crowd to say, you know, Oswald is guilty and this is why. This is the evidence. But she never done it. And I just felt like the man has a defence. Of course he does. But there was no room for any dissenting voice that night at the Dupree Theatre. In fact, Ruth Payne actually said during the talk, and I open my articles with it, she says she doesn't like speaking to conspiracy theorists. And I just felt like saying, well, the HSCA, who was the last official body to investigate this case, said that the president was killed by a probable conspiracy. So I just found it to be very...
disingenuous, right? Just, yeah, the fraud comes to mind. And, like, it was so bad that you had the inclination to get up and walk out. Like, you know, the shit around here is getting so thick I need a shovel, you know?
Yeah, I wish I did. I do wish I did. But I did think to myself that I don't want it to be seen like I'm badgering an old woman. Because Ruth Payne is really old now. And
yeah, but you know what? They're using her... like a dog and pony show, the guy like a puppet show. The thing is, if she said, I'll talk to someone doing political research, I'll talk to someone who's a historian, what are the facts, and give us your side of the story, it's fine that she is giving her side of the story, but her side of knowingly is not the facts about how the, you know, when you said that the, her home is on for visit, you know, and there's a man like her Carcano in the garage. I just went, oh, sure there is, you know? Like, oh, my God, of course.
Yeah,
sorry, one last thing. With Jeff Carter, when I made 50 Reasons for 50 Years, he titled that episode about her, The Payne's Garage, and it was called The Gift That Keeps Giving. Whenever they needed something, they found it in the Payne's Garage.
Well, yeah, it's very true. I mean, I remember last time I was on, I spoke to you about being in the garage at the Payne house, and I joked at the time that this is probably the only time a man like a Carcano rifle's actually been in this garage. Yeah, I mean, it is, and we'll touch on this a bit later in the talk, but I think this is why Mrs. Payne pushes the Walker angle so much, because for all intent and purposes, the Walker note materialised from the house in Irvine. I mean, it was apparently secreted within a book for Russian mothers, which Ruth Payne then gave to the Irvine police, who then passed it on to the Secret Service. But this note, the Secret Service opened the book and this note fell out. In fact, Mrs. Payne comments upon it in the talk. She says, what's the first thing a Secret Service man has got to do? And she makes this noise, she goes, do, 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 see what falls out. And then, of course, Mr. Gapodze of the Secret Service then contacted her almost immediately. And they went out to see her in Irvine, I think, the next day. And they basically accosted her over this note because they thought that she had wrote it. And during Ruth's testimony, she actually says that. She says she comes across as very shocked that Mr. Gapodze actually thinks that she has wrote the note. That is also an interesting point as well. But, you know, there was times within this talk, Len, that it became really uncomfortable. I mean, Ruth made this statement. She asked the people, she says, how many of you know that Oswald, and most of you should because you're here, but how many of you know that Oswald tried to kill Edwin Walker in April in 1963? And Mrs. Payne's arm raised first, and there was a sea of arms scattered throughout the crowd with her hands were going up, and she said in response to this, showing the support, there you go, good crowd, and she started laughing, and so did the people in the audience. And I was very disturbed by this. I mean, we're talking about an attempted murder, we're also talking about a man who they're basically trying to play almost like getting their cheapies out of like someone's innocence or guilt. And I find that really disturbing. Like, hands up if you know Oswald's guilty. Like, that's just totally deplorable in my opinion.
No, it is. You know, and the thing is, it should be hands up if you've heard that he's been accused of shooting at Walker. Well, let's look at the evidence. Does anybody think he did? Does anybody think he didn't? Where does the evidence lie, you know?
Well, this is the most obvious question I would love to have put to Ruth Payne. Why would Oswald try and kill a right-wing fascist like Edwin Walker and then shoot the most liberal president since Franklin Roosevelt? It makes no sense. So, but she was really hell-bent on trying to convince this audience that Oswald was guilty in the Walker case. And obviously Marina's testimony is cited, and we know the problems with Marina's testimony. Like, there was, as I've said before, there was various people that was commenting upon this. Norman Redlich. Now, you know who Redlich is, right? He was a prosecutor for the Warren Commission. And he basically said about Marina that Marina has repeatedly lied to the Secret Service, the FBI, and this commission on matters which are of vital concern to the people of this country. And that Marina may not have told the truth in connection with the attempt on General Walker. And then you've got J. Lee Rankin writing to J. Edgar Hoover, stating that Marina's testimony on the Walker shooting to the FBI and the Secret Service was giving the commission's lawyers fits because it was riddled with contradictions. So, like, she has, unfortunately, and I'm sure Marina had her own reasons for going along with it and being a cooperative witness. But to offer Marina's testimony as evidence that Oswald was guilty in the Walker case is frankly quite puzzling to me and to anyone that knows the record.
My favorite quote from her is when she's giving testimony, and I think it's to the House Select Committee on Assassination, and she says, after, you know, questioning, "I forgot what I was supposed to say."
Yeah.
And then as soon as you hear that, you go, "Oh, they told you, say this, say that. I forgot what I was supposed to say."
Yeah, well, she says in one of her testimonies, she was like, she says something along the lines of, "I want you to know, I want to help you." You know? And that was in her first testimony in Volume 1. So, yeah, she was a very cooperative witness. But just going back very, very slightly to the backyard photographs, when Mr. Mallon was showing the backyard photographs on the overhead projector here, and he was offering these as evidence that Oswald was complicit in the general's attempted murder, something really sprang to mind to me, and I've been a proponent of this for quite a while, and that is, what is the legal considerations of the backyard photographs? Because a man, according to Texas law, husband and wife cannot testify, can't be used to testify against each other in criminal cases. The only exception to this rule is if Oswald was put on trial for something that he'd done directly to Marina. But for the Kennedy assassination, Marina couldn't even have testified against Lee. So, considering, as the story goes, Marina is the only witness to the backyard photographs, she's the one that takes them, apparently, then because of this fact, the backyard photographs couldn't actually be admitted into a court of law to be used against Oswald, because the prosecution, Henry Wade in this instance, would have to have relied on Marina's testimony, and he couldn't do it. And Marina actually testifies to this point. She says, "As far as I know, according to the local laws here, a wife cannot be a witness against her husband." So even Marina knew that. But of course, the Warren Commission never allowed Oswald or permitted Oswald to have legal assistance. I mean, Mark Lane was denied his petition to represent Oswald. And instead, they let a guy called Walter Craig, who was president of the American Bar Association, to be there to sit in on these hearings. But Craig never objected to any of the leading questions, and there was a myriad of them. There was lots of leading questions. I mean, if you even take, for example, the testimony of Helen Markham, was there a number two man in there? You know, of course, if Oswald had a competent defence lawyer like Mark Lane, that would have been objected to. Mark Lane, of course, as well, would have been admitting exculpatory evidence of Oswald, calling his own witnesses, cross-examining witnesses as well. And that's very crucial in this case. how can you elicit any truth from somebody without first subjecting them to cross-examination? You can't do it. So if Marina was allowed to have been cross-examined by a Mark Lane, her testimony probably would have read a whole lot. It would have been a whole different ballgame. It would have been just different to what we know it is now. But because the commission never permitted Oswald to have any defence, they were allowed to just press ahead with this, again, dog and pony, the charade, which turned out to be the Warren Commission report. So, and it still continues to this day. I mean, you've got people like Ruth Payne and Thomas Mallon still trying to prop up the commission. And you've even commented on it during the talk itself about the report, saying, I think Thomas Mallon asked Ruth, the report still holds up today, and Ruth was in wholeheartedly agreement with him, saying, oh, yes, yes, it holds up. But and if you just take a look at, for example, Chokeholds, which is the new book by Jim Paul, Matt Crumpton, etc. The first chapter, I think, Paul actually impeaches the Warren Commission report by the evidence that we have and the various statements of people, you know, in the commission, like Bob Kennedy, people like the late Richard Schweiker. Yeah, and it's a very interesting read. So to still be trying to prop up the Warren Commission report 60 years after the fact is not a smart move, because there's been so many holes shot in the Warren Commission report that it should have its own funeral and on its own autopsy, you know. But yeah, and then it went from there to the Walker note. And I don't know how much you know about the Walker note, but it was getting heralded as like one of the Ten Commandments almost. Like it was so you can't even question it. Its authenticity, right? But for the listeners who are not aware of the Walker note, this note, which is apparently written by Lee Oswald, and it is kept, apparently, as insurance by Marina in case Oswald ever wants to go out again and try something of the silk, she's going to dob him into the Dallas police. That's allegedly how the story goes. But there's more than a few problems with this note, because the note itself doesn't actually mention General Walker. There is no signature by the writer, and the note is not dated. There is also no fingerprints of Oswald or Marina found on the note, because the FBI did test it for fingerprints. Of course, the Secret Service thought that Mrs. Payne had wrote the Walker note, or initially thought that she had wrote it. The House Select Committee on Assassinations, they asked three experts to assess the authenticity of the Walker note, and there was no majority consensus that the note was written by Oswald, which again raises serious doubts about the note's legitimacy and its alleged connection to Oswald and to the Walker shooting. Also as well, and this is an interesting point, the Ruth Payne home, it was actually owned by Michael Payne, but the home in Irvine was extensively searched by the Dallas police on the 22nd and the 23rd of November. And the Dallas police basically went in there with a fine-tooth comb and took basically everything out of the house. And they came back on the 23rd. Well, Ruth Payne testified that the police turned up to her home just as she was preparing to go to the grocery store, okay, to get messages in. And the police apparently turned up. They asked Ruth Payne if they could search the home, and she says yes, they could. And apparently the police relayed to her that they were looking for something specific. So then Mrs. Payne decided to leave the police inside of her house while they rummaged through and searched everything, which is normal behaviour. She said before she left, she noticed the police officers were leafing through books to see if anything fell out. Okay? Now, during the talk that I witnessed, Ruth was saying that the note was contained within a little book that Marina had, and it was advice to Russian mothers. And the book happened to be in the kitchen, and Ruth says, which then made it different from the things in the garage, because they didn't get that note, she was saying, okay? Well, there was a couple of points that came to my mind. Well, if this book was in regular use by Marina, which Ruth was conveying to the audience that it was, then how didn't the note not fall out, you know, of the book when she was reading it? She obviously must have been well aware that the note was there. And secondly, this is 1960s Texas, you know, height of the Cold War, you know. It stretches credibility to suggest that a book intended for Russian mothers would go undetected by Texas police officers during a property search, you know. And the way the Ruth Payne House is, and if any of your listeners have ever been there, they'll know what I'm talking about. When you go in through the front door, you've got the living room, you've got a doorway right in front of you, and you've got a doorway to your right-hand side. Well, if you take the doorway right in front of you, you're standing in the kitchen, come dining room area of the house. And immediately to your left is the internal door for the garage. So the police officers would have been walking through her front door into her kitchen dining room area to then get into the garage to be taking stuff. Well, if the book for Russian mothers is in our kitchen, how could it not be noticed by the police officers conducting the search? It makes absolutely no sense. And only if you've been there or you've seen pictures of the house will you truly understand this and get this point. So it seemed utterly baffling to me that if this was genuinely actually in the house, that it wouldn't have been picked up by a police officer. Also, initially, Marina Oswald, well, apparently she pleaded ignorance to the existence of the Walker note. She said that she didn't know what the Secret Service was talking about, and then very quickly she changed her mind after and came up with a story that Oswald apparently, he wrote the note, it was all about Walker, etc. But the funny thing is, there is evidence on the record, and this is during Marina's testimony, that at her insistence, Oswald apparently destroys other pieces of evidence that he created, apparently, to do with the Walker shooting. So apparently Oswald had this notebook, and he kept plans in it.
Thank goodness we have her word for it.
Yeah, exactly. But this is what she's trying to say. She's trying to say Oswald had all these drawings, all these plans, what she was going to do, what he was going to do to Walker. And she testified that Marina testified that she was so afraid after this attempt on Walker's life that the police might come to the house and that there'd be evidence in the house, such as this notebook, that Marina told Lee that it's best to not have this kind of stuff laying about. And she apparently suggested to him to burn it. So apparently, according to Marina, that's what he did.
Yep. Oh, he burned it, according to her.
Yeah. But this is the scenario presented by Marina's testimony regarding the note is fraught with paradoxes and inconsistencies, because it is indeed paradoxical that while she claimed to have urged Lee to destroy this notebook, detailing all the plans for the attack on General Walker, okay, she seemingly allowed the Walker note to remain in her possession. And the backyard photographs.
Well, I mean, the whole joke is that if you don't believe Lee shot JFK and he didn't shoot Walker, then this investigation of how he could have done it is just, it's like this thing that Ruth Payne, it's like a meeting of the Flat Earth Society. Just explaining how the world is flat and people raising their hand. Yeah, it's flat.
Yeah, well, Wesley Liebler, who was commission counsel, he raised an interesting point to Marina. He said, if Oswald was guilty in the Walker shooting, why would he keep the photos and the note around for almost 8 months? Which is a very good point. Of course, the whole scenario of Oswald shooting at General Walker, it's ludicrous. And we know it's ludicrous. Why do we know it's ludicrous? Because we've got eyewitness testimony, we've got affidavits from eyewitnesses, and we've got the evidence. Now, Walker was shot at an April 10th, on April 10th, 1963. And no one's seen the shooting take place, but a young lad, a 15-year-old lad by the name of Walter Coleman, who was a neighbour of General Walker's, he swore in an affidavit that immediately after the Walker shooting, he noticed two men fleeing the scene. One of the men got into a 1950 Ford, which had its motor running and its headlights on, in the car park next to Walker's house. Because, to set the scene a little bit, to get to this car park, you go up a ramp right next to Walker's house. Back in 1963, there was a Mormon church there, and there was a car park for the church. And where Walker was shot from was a lane. And I've stood in that lane. I visited there when I was in Dallas there in November. So Coleman apparently hears the shots. He runs outside and jumps on his bike and looks over the fence. And he sees one guy running towards this Ford. And he says that the motor's running and the headlight's on. And then he says that further down the parking lot, there was another car. It was a two-door black over white Chevrolet sedan. And he says a man was in it. The man had the light of the car on. And Kirk could see the guy bending over the front seat as if he was putting something in the back floorboard, you know, the car. Now, the first guy who Kirk described, he said one of the men who took off in the Ford was a white male. He was about 19 or 20 years of age. He was 5'10 and he weighed about 130 pounds. He was wearing khaki pants, sports shirt with figures on it. And this man had dark, bushy hair, a thin face with a large nose. And he was real skinny. Well, the second man was described as about 6'1, about 200 pounds, wearing a dark long sleeve shirt and dark pants. Okay? Well, Coleman, after the assassination by the FBI, was shown a picture of Lee Harvey Oswald. And he was asked to basically, was Oswald one of these two men? And Coleman stated that he had seen numerous pictures of Oswald on TV and in the newspapers. And he was shown a photograph of Oswald. And he stated that Oswald resembled neither of the men that he seen near Walker's home on April the 10th, 1963. So that's a very important point. And I don't think it will come as much of a shock to you to say that the name of Walter Kirk Coleman was not mentioned once by Mrs. Payne or Mr. Mallon at the Dupree Theatre on November 20th, 2023. Well, the other point is as well, 2 days before the Walker shooting, a guy called Robert Surrey, who was one of General Walker's supporters, noticed two men scoping out the Walker residence. He said these two guys who Surrey followed. So basically, Surrey got out of his car. He observed these two men walk up the alley onto Walker's property and look in the windows of Walker's house. And he said that he actually then went to the car that the two men occupied, and he searched the car. He said the car had no license plate, and there was nothing in the glove compartment, and there was nothing basically in the car which would help Surrey identify who the occupants were. And Surrey testified to the Warren Commission that the gist of the matter is the 2 nights before the assassination attempt, he saw these two men around the house peeking into the windows, and that they reported this to the police. And obviously, when they reported it on the Wednesday after Walker was shot at. And Surrey was also shown pictures of Lee Harvey Oswald. And he said that none of the men were Lee Harvey Oswald. So that's two different witnesses at two different times that said that people acting suspicious around Walker's home 48 hours prior to the shooting and directly after the shooting, none of these men were Lee Harvey Oswald. But of course, this doesn't get mentioned by Ruth or by Thomas Mallon. Now, the second bit of exculpatory evidence, as I touched on earlier, the Dallas police had stated that the bullet fired at Walker appeared to be from a high-powered 30-06 rifle, and it was a steel-jacketed bullet. And in fact, in the article, I include this bit of an article for the New York Times, dated April 11th, 1963, and it confirms that the bullet fired at Walker was from a 30-06. Well, the bullet that now sits in the National Archives and purportedly has came from the Walker house is now a 6.5 Mannlicher Carcano. It's not steel jacketed, it's copper coated. And of course, the Warren Commission, they used the Walker shooting to basically proclaim in the report that with Oswald having tried to attempt to kill Walker, it then demonstrated his disposition to take human life, which then gave them an excuse to then say, see, because he tried to kill Edwin Walker, we then know he killed President Kennedy. But, I mean, General Walker himself, he actually said that the bullet which sits in the National Archives today is not the bullet that was fired at him that night. And if I just see here, Walker basically was watching, I think it was in the 1970s, he was watching the HSCA's, one of the hearings on the HSCA, and basically the Walker bullet was brought out. And Walker basically said that the bullet that was being presented by Robert Blakey was not the bullet that he held in his hand that day. And Walker made a really big point of this. And in fact, he started this campaign. He wrote to Robert Blakey of HSCA and basically asked them to take that, the bullet purported to be the Walker bullet, the 6.5. He wanted it out of the National Archives because he vehemently protested and said that that was not the bullet that was fired at him that night. He said he held that piece of lead in his hand and that was not the bullet that they were trying to present during the HSCA. So that was very interesting. I thought that was a very interesting point as well. So there was another couple of obviously good points that I came across, and I remember years ago I read a book called Breach of Trust by Gerald McKnight, and it's a really good book. And he's got a really, Gerald McKnight is dead now, but he has got a really good section on the Walker shooting in Breach of Trust. And according to Marina, Oswald apparently on April 8th, it would be the 8th, he goes to Walker's house, he hides the rifle in a bush near his home. He goes all the way back to 10 Ely Street, and then on the 10th he leaves Neely Street to try and shoot at Walker. But of course, it's obviously ridiculous, but there was a few things that I highlighted in the article why this would be utterly preposterous, this scenario. Because of course, if you're hiding a rifle in a bush, uncovered, then you're exposing the rifle to rain, humidity, could be extreme temperatures, which obviously could impair its functionality. And that could obviously lead to potential malfunctions when you go to shoot the rifle. Of course, by leaving it outside, the rifle also could rust, and which would then negatively affect the rifle's accuracy and its reliability. You're then subjecting it to an accumulation of dirt and debris, which could obstruct the barrel or jam the firing mechanism. And just like stuff like, what is the logic in a guy hiding a rifle in a bush? You know, what happens if that rifle's discovered and Oswald goes to pick up that rifle and then the police are there waiting for him, or they take the rifle away? You know, that's just that. I mean, you're just inviting the discovery, prematurely someone discovering the rifle, reporting it to the police, which also could result in a premature arrest or foiling the attempted assassination of Walker. Of course, if there's ammunition in the rifle, and the ammunition is stored in a similar way to the rifle in the bush, this could also affect its efficacy and its reliability could be compromised. It just kind of goes on and on, really. And in Sylvia Marr's excellent book, Excesses After the Fact, which to me is still my Bible on the Kennedy case, I just think it's an unbelievable book, and it was written in 1967. She, in her section of the Walker case, she posits these questions, and I think it was actually done hand in hand with a French journalist called Leo Savage. How did Oswald, because Marina testifies that after the Walker shooting, Oswald runs down to these train tracks, buries the rifle in the ground, then goes back to Neely Street. Well, how did Oswald bury a rifle in the ground without using a spade or a shovel or any other implement other than his bare hands, which is a very valid point? How did Oswald protect the rifle from corrosion and other damage to be expected if the rifle was buried in soil for some 4 days? If Oswald used no protective wrappings on the rifle, then why did the microscopic examination of the rifle by Paul Stombaugh on November 23rd, 1963, reveal no traces of oil? And since Oswald buried the rifle in the dark of night, how did he locate the place of the burial 4 days later? And how did he dig up the rifle without a shovel or any other implement? And of course, Sylvia Meagher caveats that with, you know, during the many searches of Oswald's property and possessions after the assassination by the local and federal agents, they uncovered no rifle cleaning equipment. You know? So.
Yeah, like I say, it's a flat earth society.
Yeah. Well, what's quite interesting, Len, is that during his testimony, because Walker did testify, they didn't want him to testify, but because of pressures, they actually had no choice but to call him. They never showed him Commission Exhibit 573. Which is the Walker bullet, which is the bullet that sits in the National Archives today, and asked them to confirm its authenticity. This was very important because, of course, with him picking up the bullet in his study that night, he was a link in the custody chain, you know? All the officers who attended the shooting that night, Dallas police officers like Van Cleve, McElroy, Tucker and Norville, none of them were called to give testimony before the Warren Commission. Walter Coleman was not called to testify before the Warren Commission. Why is there no contemporaneous photographs of the Walker bullet taken on the 10th of April 1963? And why are they not in the record? You know? And how does anyone, Mrs. Payne or Mr. Mallon or anybody else who advocates for Oswald's guilt, interpret the fact that Oswald was not considered a suspect in the Walker case until after his death? So it's all very a matter of fact, after the assassination, Oswald's dead. Oh, yeah, by the way, he also took a shot at General Walker. And I say it in the article, if Henry Wade, if Oswald had went to trial, okay, and Henry Wade was trying to prove that he had tried to attempt to assassinate Edwin Walker, okay, his case would have been fraught with a series of significant hurdles. And it would have just been a game. It would just been an evidentiary debacle. It would have been fraught with logistical improbabilities. And Wade would have to have surmounted formidable challenges to even prove Oswald guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in this thing. Because it can't be done. And Walker actually testified himself that he had no way of knowing that Oswald attacked him. And he wasn't very prone to say that, in fact, Oswald did shoot at him. I know, obviously, Walker changed his tune about that, and he did then believe that Oswald did shoot at him. But that's what he testified before the Warren Commission. But, again, none of the things that I've touched upon there, Lynn, none of these important pieces of information none of them was ever conveyed to the audience that night. And the question is why? You know?
Well, because their complete fraud falls apart on, you know, investigation. As soon as you start, and the whole thing is like that. What makes you think he shot at Walker? And if he didn't shoot at Walker, maybe he didn't kill Tippit. And if he didn't kill Tippit, then he didn't shoot JFK. And if he didn't do any of that, he's a patsy, like he said. And, oh, well, we better change our point of view and say, well, who really did the shooting then? You know?
Yeah. In my other articles on Jim's website, my 60 reasons piece, I basically obviously listed 60 points why the Warren Commission report is a fraudulent document and the fact that Oswald was innocent. And I just tried to convey to people what Oswald was like, as in what people's testimony on the record is regarding Oswald. Was Oswald a psychopathic presidential assassin, or was he a 24-year-old introvert who had two children and adored them? Now, Oswald wasn't a model husband. He wasn't. But, and they did touch upon this at the talk as well. Thomas Mallon says that Oswald used to beat Marina, etc. And
well, there's two sides to that story too, right? If you, you mentioned.
Well, there is. And I mean, again, in Norman Redlich, there was a guy called James H. Martin, okay? And he became kind of like Marina's manager almost after the assassination. And Martin, and Norman Redlich writes this in 1964, that Martin had consciously attempted to try and create a public image of Marina Oswald as a simple, devoted housewife who'd suffered at the hands of her husband, who was now filled with remorse for her husband's actions and deeply grateful for the generosity and the understanding of the American people. And Martin's testimony actually indicated that there is a strong possibility that Marina Oswald is in fact a very different person. A cold, calculating, scornful of generosity, capable of an extreme lack of sympathy in personal relationships, and a wife who married her husband for selfish motives, degraded him in public and taunted him about his inadequacies. Now, George DeMonshield, the DeMonshields testified to this point to the Warren Commission. And George DeMonshield basically said that Marina and Lee used to fight, they bickered, she annoyed him, she brought out the worst in him. And after Lee and Marina would get into a fight, Marina would openly tell George DeMonshield that she would fight him back. She would scratch him, she would fight Lee back. Apparently, she used to annoy him all the time by basically saying to him, "Why don't you make some money? Why don't they have a car as a family? Why doesn't Lee buy her more dresses? Look at everyone else living so well, and they were just miserable flunkies, you know." George also said that in front of him and his wife, Marina would complain bitterly that Lee would only sleep with her once a month, and that she would never get any satisfaction out of it. And George actually said it was a rather crude and completely straightforward thing to say in front of relative strangers, as they were. And Jean DeMonshield says the same thing. She says that Marina used to taunt him about, like, just his inadequacies, the fact that she was given all these dresses by various people, and Lee apparently objected to all this kind of lavish help because Marina was thrown it all in his face. So, yeah, so when Oswald obviously engaged in physical abuse, and it does seem that the physical abuse was also mutual as well, Marina engaged in mental abuse of Oswald, and that's something that doesn't get any screen time at all. So, in my opinion, both are just as deplorable as each other. I think also what people have got to realise is this was a 1960s marriage, a very complicated marriage, of course, and both of them are just as bad as each other. It's certainly not this narrative that Oswald's this monster and Marina's this angel. They were both as bad as each other, Lynn.
Well, I urge everyone to read your article. Part 2 is up. Compliment it just, I think, a couple of days ago. So it is Our Lady of the Warren Commission and by Johnny Cairns. It's all there. And like I say, the further you look into this, the more doubts there are. And for her to be going up and, you know, saying, oh, raise your hand if you know this, if you know that, right? Oh, God. It's like a Flat Earth Society meeting, preaching to each other.
It's quite funny.
You know, it's worse than that, because the thing is that if you admire someone like John Kennedy trying to change the world to make it a better place, and people up against him said, no, we want the old order, we want industrial and military complex, we want constant war, that's what we want, and we'll kill people who offer something against that. And then, you know, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and how many countless others, right? Look at Julian Assange these days, still in prison, you know?
Yeah, I see that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is advocating for a full pardon for Julian Assange. But, you know, there was another thing during the talk that quite disturbed me, and I don't know if you know about this, but basically Ruth Payne complained bitterly, I would say, that Oswald phoned her on November 23rd and asked Ruth to contact John Apt for her. And she complains bitterly about that, which I don't understand, because, like, what I don't understand is, what evidence had Ruth Payne seen on November the 22nd, 1963, that convinced her beyond any doubt that Oswald was the sole assassin of President John Kennedy? And if she's trying to make Oswald out to be this dangerous individual who would even attempt to undertake something this monstrous, then why did she permit this man's family and this man to stay at her house, play with her own children, play with the children of the neighbourhood? It makes absolutely no sense, you know? And of course, it is in the Bill of Rights, you know, that Oswald had the right to counsel, and he had the presumption of innocence. Yet Oswald is still alive. He's claiming that he's innocent, vehemently denies the charges against him. And Ruth Payne takes the stance of, he had the audacity to phone me on November 23rd and asked if I would do him a favour and phone him a lawyer. Like, to me, that's just, like, crazy. And there's a story in the Bible. I'm Catholic. Mrs. Payne's obviously Christian herself, and let he who is without sin cast the first stone, Jesus said. Well, Mrs. Payne was casting a whole host of stones that night, and they were falling in the direction of Lee Harvey Oswald. And I just can't believe how she can just treat him like he's kind of nothing, like he has no rights. I mean, I've never heard Ruth Payne once lament the death of Lee Harvey Oswald. I've never heard her say, yeah, Oswald's death is a tragedy or anything like that, you know? And this is a guy she knew. But it's very clear to me just the absolute contempt that she has for Oswald. She doesn't like him at all. So that doesn't make her, in my opinion, a neutral observer in this thing. So, but the evidence doesn't support contempt. But the evidence doesn't support what Mrs. Payne and Mr. Mallon was trying to sell to the audience that night. And you can make up your own mind as well, because the whole talk's on YouTube. But obviously being there and seeing it for ourselves, and, you know, Scott Reed told me afterwards that he was really obviously disturbed by what was going on. And Neil Safety said it was the biggest waste of $62 he had ever spent.
Holy shit. That's up. Yep.
And afterwards, we all went to this Irish bar on Main Street in Dallas, because we just felt like we had to have a beer, because we were kind of so disturbed by what we were hearing. But yeah, it was. I'm glad I went. I'm glad I got to see her. But my biggest regret was not standing up and walking out in disgust.
The only plus side to that is that it didn't get any better. So it's not like, oh, in the second half they changed the format, and then, you know. So at least you saw that it was a complete whitewash, the fraud of that point of view. And like I said, the only thing I can compare it to is a World is Flat Society.
Well, they did take questions. And there was a lot of the DP UK guys that did ask questions. I never asked a question. But Thomas Mallon was acting as gatekeeper. So he was just flicking through the questions. And then he would ask Ruth, like, some very, like, very soft question about...
Oh, you had to write the question down. So he said, okay, nope, okay.
Yeah, he was shifting through them.
Yeah. Just a typical obfuscation. Well, at least you saved me. I'm not going to watch the YouTube video because I don't want to waste another hour. It's like crazy that these people, but some people believe them. And there is people who believe the world is flat, so.
Aldous Huxley once said, facts do not cease to exist because they are ignored. And all the exculpatory evidence, all the facts surrounding Oswald's innocence in this case, and in these cases, were ignored by Mrs. Payne and Mr. Mallon. And it just goes to show that 60 years after the terrible events of November 1963, there is still people that is trying to cover up the facts surrounding the assassination of President Kennedy and still trying to, you know, herald Lee Oswald as...
Well, as soon as you heard that they were locking up documents for 75 years and on the 60th anniversary they're still hiding documents, you know what a fraud that is. And you end the article with a very good quote. It says, the worst form of injustice is pretend justice. And that's from Plato.
Yeah, that's right. And it is. You know, I feel really bad for Oswald's family. Rachel and June, his daughters. They've lived with a stigma of this thing for over 60 years.
On the other side of the coin, I've heard that a lot of people who have ever met them have said, we don't believe this Warren Commission. We don't believe this crap. So, you know, regardless of what happened, we don't think your father did this. And he was used by the intelligence, just like he was sent to Russia to the Soviet Union to be a phony defector. And then, well, but that's another whole other topic. I know you've got to get going and time is short, so I just thank you for the time today. Is there any one thing you just want to bring up quickly before we wrap up?
Yeah, sure. So I don't know if anyone picked up on, but I'm a member of Dealey Plaza UK, which is we're obviously based in the UK, and it's a group that's dedicated to the assassination of President Kennedy, researching aspects of the president's life and his presidency. And we have various seminars each year. This year it's in York and in Canterbury. And we have monthly Zoom talks where we'll have people presenting their research. And the last one we had was Chris Gallup. We've had Jim DiEugenio on there. We've had William Law, Bill Simpich, Larry Hancock, Paul Blaw, Robert Groden. And it's a fantastic group to be involved in. And we do have an American branch as well. There's a lot of people over in the States that tune in at the Zoom meetings. And it's a fantastic place to learn more, to present your own research. And if anyone is interested in joining, then there's a Dealey Plaza UK website, there's a Facebook page, and just to reach out to our secretary, Neil Safety, or Peter Antill, who does the memberships. It's a very worthwhile group. I'm presenting at York this year, along with some other really profound speakers. And the great Malcolm Blunt, he's an honorary member of Dealey Plaza UK. And Bart Camp, he obviously just wrote the book about Prayer Man More Than a Fuzzy Picture. He's an honorary member of Dealey Plaza UK as well. If anyone's interested in joining, then more the merrier. You're always welcome.
Very good. We'll make links to that in the show notes.
Thanks, Glenn. I really appreciate that.
Okay, Johnny, thank you very much for taking time today, being part of Black Op Radio again, and also writing it. Your articles are at Kennedy's and King, and of course we'll make all the appropriate links to that. All right, until next time, thank you very much.
Thanks, Len. God bless.
All right, you too. Good night.